from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Voitin.
It is Thursday. It's Fresh Friday's Eve here on the G and Ursula Show. And today is, is it terrific? Is it terrible? What kind of Thursday is it?
Well,
Ursula?
At one point I said thriving Thursday. A lot of people were saying throwback Thursday.
Okay. All right.
We checked in with ChatGPT and we've got some options. Thankful Thursday, thoughtful Thursday, thrilling Thursday, thirsty Thursday, thunderous Thursday, theater Thursday, thick Thursday. But then Chef typed in, well, hey, can you provide more examples that maybe are funny? So see if you like any of these. Thumping Thursday, Thug Thursday, Thwarted Thursday, Themed Thong Thursday. Okay. There's a parentheses here. Note, this may be inappropriate or offensive to some people. And then there is the fan favorite, Thundering Thighs Thursday.
I can't believe you're actually saying some of these things.
I vote for Thickest Thursday, in which we start out the show by twerking on the news desk.
Going to have a thick Thursday.
Okay, well, and while we're talking about what day it really
is, going on today?
Should we be treating it like a Fresh Friday today? We're going to talk about how the old work week has pretty much gone extinct around here. So that's coming up in top stories. Right now, we invite you to engage with us on our state roofing text line, 888-973-5476, 888-973 Cairo.
I'm with Allie in Tacoma. I vote for Thick Thursday. It's time to get the people what they want. Ursula's top news stories of the day brought to you by Wayscar Ford Isuzu in Auburn.
Well, let's get right into it then. Now that the worst of the pandemic is over, workers are returning to downtown Seattle, but new data shows most of them are not driving there 5 days a week. According to Commute Seattle, about 60% of downtown's 320,000 workers are driving to the office on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, even more than that on Thursdays. But then most employees continue to work from home on Mondays and Fridays. The Seattle Times spoke with business owners who say, yep, they've noticed a drop in sales and customers on Mondays and Fridays. And the report also shows a drop in overall public transit use.
My favorite part of this article was this is the part I read. This is the notes that I took down of everything that was in that thing. It said, now that COVID social distancing rules have waned, Seattle commuters are redefining hump day as not merely the midpoint of the work week, but as the apex of traffic and congestion. So I said to myself, self, when it gets to Wednesday, is Wednesday really the, you know, like that is the day? It's hump day, but is that's like the most work is done on Wednesday? And Ursula, I ain't gonna lie to you. I agree. Because once Thursday hits, did you notice how I opened the show up? I said today was Fresh Friday's Eve. That lets you know that the vast majority of people, when it comes to work, really, your Thursday is your Friday. And Friday, how many of y'all return emails on a Friday?
Hey, I do. I return emails on a weekend. One of my biggest pet peeves is when you know that someone has sent you an email or you know someone has sent you a
text message. And Chef
oh,
don't
you
respond?
Just, oh, yeah. You just wait on it. You could have answered it, but you just wait on it.
Yeah.
Because I don't like that, I don't do that generally. And if I accidentally do that, I apologize profusely. But let's talk about some of the impacts this is having.
Uh-huh.
So basically, if you look at the data as well, you can see that tenants in the second half of 2022 leased 1.2 million square feet. That's down 25% from the second half of 2021 and 40% down from the second half of 2019. So there's a lot of empty office space.
Okay.
So of course that's going to affect the businesses downtown. But here's another thing that was interesting from this Commute Seattle data, and it was in conjunction with the University of Washington, and it's one of the largest reports, or you know, basically the most research done on what has the pandemic and what is post-pandemic happening with the commute. And people who work downtown just aren't returning downtown to work like they used to. So the question is that a good thing? Is that something that we can sustain? So the head of the Downtown Seattle Association, John Scholes, is going to join us next hour. And he says a lot of progress is being made downtown because we always talk about, you know, downtown has been a mess, especially in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
It is coming back. Tourists are back, but the workers are not. So should they? He says there are four things that need to happen before Seattle can truly thrive once again, downtown Seattle specifically. And one of those is to bring more workers back to the office.
Okay.
I happen to agree with him.
I don't know why you do.
I know.
I don't know why you do. You just said something. You said, can we sustain? First of all, when did you start speaking French? That's first of all. Second of all, my next question is who's we? Ursula, can you sustain?
As a region.
No, I'm talking you. Can you sustain if people don't come back to work like they did pre-pandemic?
I personally can.
Okay.
But
okay.
We often talk about how we need and we want this region to be back to where it was years ago in its quote unquote glory days. And there are some who could argue, hey, we're in the glory days right now. If you look, you know, economically at some areas or whatever, but downtown has suffered, especially during the pandemic. And my belief is, right now, a lot is coming back and there's a lot to be thankful for. Mm-hmm. And there's a big effort to clean up the streets. You know, we had some of our crew
physically went out there. We got out there and cleaned up.
Yep. Exactly. So physically we went out there, but we saw problem areas. You know, we talk every day about the issues that need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And one of those things is going to be, if you don't bring the workers back, then you need to have something else because there's a whole lot of empty buildings and there's a whole lot of commerce not happening. So what's it going to be? So what direction do you go?
Reimagine like they keep feeling so good. Reimagine.
Okay. That's
downtown.
A great word, but what does that mean?
We you gotta start changing things up. You gotta go with the artsy. Let's get more restaurants and all this stuff downtown. You're gonna get more restaurants. You're gonna get more
restaurants with people from where coming in? Just tourists? You can't do just tourists.
So let's keep it a buck right now, okay? For all those listening at home or on the car, downtown Seattle is never going to be what it was. It's like a relationship, Ursula, and I got a lot of history when it comes to relationship. There's some things that happens during a relationship where you look at each other and say, we will never be like it was. The global pandemic that hit us really has changed everything, y'all.
Yeah, but there are, I mean, and you're correct, but proportionally, Seattle has more people not returning downtown. So what is it? I mean, and
why?
We talk about public safety, crime.
Technology.
But the other thing is high tech.
Seattle's a tech hub, and you're 1,000% right. Seattle, like every major city in the nation, is going to have to adapt to this new world, and it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be a painful transition. But why should we ask workers to bail out the economy of downtown Seattle with their pocketbooks and their gas tanks because the world has changed? When technology changes, the world changes, and you can either choose to be a Luddite or you can adapt, okay?
Oh,
and if you don't
Lord.
Know what a Luddite is, back in the 1800s, when the technology to make textile mills was created, the Luddites were the textile workers who would go around and destroy the textile mills because the textile mills were taking their jobs. Now, all these businesses in downtown Seattle and all the people saying, you got to come back. You got to come back to fix our economy. Well, when does the economy ever adapt to workers when new technology comes around? Because this is actually a benefit to workers. And what we're saying is, you know what? We need to abandon this new technological advance. We need to abandon our climate goals. We need to get people back in their cars and get them back down into the offices so they can work like they used to. That's not the world. It's changed. I'm sorry. My pocketbook doesn't need to pay for that.
I 100% hear you, Chef, and anyone else who will argue that. But I also know I've said this before, and I'll say it again. When you talk about these condensed work weeks, then you know what? If you only need people for 3 days a week and those two other days where you know who you are, you ain't working on those Mondays and Fridays, then you know what? Address that. Just go ahead and reimagine downtown. Don't bring them back. You're right. But then, again, make sure that we are working on maximum efficiency. Let's put it that
way. All of the frustration on this, I have to say one more thing.
Yeah.
This is a management problem. If you have people that are excessive and they don't need to work there and they're not working, get rid of them. No one's arguing for those folks. Get rid of them. But if you have a management problem and you can't hold your employees accountable to actually working, don't force thousands of people to come back to their jobs who don't need to be there.
Yeah.
So you're going to let them get away with that word.
Luddite, yes. I mean, come on. Okay, but I want to point out one other thing in this report. Mm-hmm. People with household incomes below $60,000 a year, they work from home at only a 19% rate citywide compared to 51% for those making $150,000 or more. You talk about an inequity, though. There is one right there. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to move on. Because we need to talk about drug use on light rail trains, which is one of the reasons people are shying away from public transit. And now Sound Transit is promising improvements for Link Light Rail to address riders' concerns. And the agency has hired four new security companies, and they're going to be putting station agents at the Northgate and Westlake stations.
People are going to be seeing significantly more security personnel throughout the system.
That is agency spokesman John Gallagher, who says crisis response teams are going to be on trains downtown. Seattle stations will be checked for people who may need drug or mental health help, and they're going to be redoubling their efforts to keep those elevators and escalators in the downtown Seattle transit tunnel running.
That sounds good. I'm impressed. I'm going to be excited. I think that we need to put a real emphasis on public transit all times, because there are people who don't want to pay the gas prices, that don't want to pay the excessive parking fees that happen in these places. So to put and clean up those areas would be a very good thing.
Oh, but you had more to say this morning about Sound Transit.
You know what?
Sorry. I just want to there's a lot you say during our morning meetings that don't come to pass during the show.
Because I think today needs to be a thriving show. And I mean, if I ask you right now, what's your thoughts on Sound Transit? You write it right away. You don't have to type it in Texas. Right away, you have a thought on Sound Transit. Yeah. Here's the problem. The thought that you have for Sound Transit is the same thought that I believe that the board of directors, those 18 elected officials that are a part of Transit, Sound Transit, they feel the same way. That's the problem. Even people that do work and connected with Sound Transit even be shading and looking at Sound Transit like they the auntie that don't never come over, and every time they come over, they just up to no good. That's why Sound Transit is one of those. So I'm sorry if there's a negative opinion about them. See, I wasn't supposed to do this. We was moving on our way. It was going
well,
things
because
good.
The reason I brought it up is. Now they are making these changes. Good that it took drivers telling them that, hey, I mean, we're getting sick from this fentanyl smoke. Now there was just an attack at the Roosevelt station, which happens to be the station closest to my home. We're already seeing a drop. I mean, it's such a huge investment. And I'm a believer in light rail. I love when I get a chance to take light rail. I love it. I don't take the bus. But I use light rail at times. And I love that it's expanding. But it's expensive as heck. And so when we're talking about these issues, it needs to be addressed with much more urgency than it is. So, yes, like you. I am glad that something is happening.
People are going to be seeing significantly more security personnel throughout the system.
Good. I'm happy for that. But that was actually a mistake. Let's move on. A prolific car thief who has stolen vehicles from several counties in Western Washington is now behind bars. 38-year-old Taylor Norton was arrested in Kirkland. His criminal history includes 22 felony convictions. Sergeant David Quiggle tells King 5 News he is a high-impact offender who's linked to vehicle thefts in King, Snohomish, and Skagit counties.
The vast majority of crimes, specifically auto theft, are committed by a small percentage of people. Being able to make an arrest, make solid cases to incarcerate that person, if they're responsible for that, we're then able to limit the number of cars that are going to be stolen over the next period of time.
Norton also has bench warrants out in Island and Whatcom counties for failing to appear in court on charges related to motor vehicle thefts again, as well as a case out of Marysville.
You can't even be mad at the dude that keeps stealing cars.
No, you can't.
You can't be mad at him for having 22 felonies and his bail set at $50,000, and he'll be able to get released with $5,000. You can't get mad if he gets to go ahead. You can't get mad at him. Now, you can get mad at the people that don't keep this dude in prison. He's had 22 felonies. There's no way in the world he should get to 23, 24, 25. This is ridiculous. And, oh, by the way, a lot of these folks that have all these felonies, it's no coincidence, Ursula, that these are the folks that go out there and commit the violent crimes.
Yeah. As long as, yeah, and I do blame the system that allows him to keep getting out and keep committing these crimes. But at 38 years old, he has 22 felony convictions, and he's able to just do it over and over and over again. And yeah, as long as he doesn't get much of a penalty at all, or if no one's even trying to track him down. Thank you, Kirkland Police, getting this guy.
Right. When he gets back out, here's my question. Will he steal cars again? I'll answer that for you. Absolutely. Yes. He will steal them again. He ain't going to stop stealing them. He's not going to stop being any crime because he's got 22 felonies. Like we talked about this morning, I grew up with the understanding that if you get one felony, man, whew, life is going to be tough. How in the world are you at 22, bruh?
Exactly.
That's not his fault.
No, that is his fault.
No.
That is his, no. It is his fault.
Okay.
But yes, he is aided and abetted with the lack of penalties for what he's doing. For sure.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, you can kind of blame him. But if he gets to 23 and 24, you know what I mean? All right. Ursula, it's good stuff today. Coming up next here on the G and Ursula Show, 2,100 encampments on state highways. And so what's happening to them? Chris Sullivan joins us next. G and Ursula.
It is 9:34. You're listening to the G and Ursula Show on this, what did you call it? Thriving Thursday. How about that?
I think that's safe.
I thought we were going with Thick Thursday.
No.
I like Thick Thursday.
A few others were going with that. I'm not.
Only the G and Ursula Show can get away with that.
But we need to talk about what is happening with all the homeless encampments on I-5. I think it was just yesterday. Other freeways, too, next to them. And I think it was just yesterday you were saying that you've noticed a difference. And then we got people saying, well, wait a minute. There's one right by Lacey, and there's one here. There's one there. At one point, there were over 2,000 of them. So what is happening? Our reporter, Chris Sullivan, has been looking into that, and he joins us right now. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Yeah. 2,100. As of September, that seemed like an awful large
yes.
number. And that could be anything from, you know, one or two people sitting there on the, you know, to the things that we've seen at Dearborn, to see what we see under the hood, the Ship Canal Bridge. They
yes.
could be of any size of any, but yeah, that seems like an, and those are just on right of way that WashDOT owns. Right. So that doesn't include any others that are around. So that seemed like a pretty big number. And as we've talked about over the last year, that this governor started this new rights of way initiative to try to find ways. And one of the hiccups with that was, well, you have to find a place for these people to go before you clean the camp. And I think you've had Matt Markovich on talking about earlier this year, there was discussions between, well, what did a home mean permanent or whatever? And so they got bogged down in semantics a little bit. But we have some numbers that are out, and they're kind of encouraging.
Okay, so what are they?
Well, so far they've attacked is the rough word, but they've gone. There's 17 homeless encampments that they're looking at right now in King, Thurston, Pierce, Snohomish, and Spokane counties. They've cleared 7 of them, and they're working on the other 10. And in those 7 that they've cleared, they've contacted 1,022 people, and 36%, 37% of them have accepted the housing. So that's the first thing you have to do. The people have to want to get out. They want to, they need to accept that help. So, I mean, of that, you know, that's not a huge number. 376 have accepted the housing out of the 1,022. But of that 376, 270 are still in that housing. So that's 72% that took the housing are still in it. So I think that's something that we need to highlight, that even though it's a small amount, it shows that this way of dealing with this issue might be bearing some positive fruit. Still have to figure out how to get that other 65% of people into to accept the housing. But yeah, so it's some positive, a little bit of positivity out of those seven camps that they've worked on so far.
So when they don't accept housing, then what happens?
Then they move on to someplace else, because
they're still forced to move.
That is correct, because they need to not only is this Rights Away initiative to find them housing, but it's then also to make sure that area doesn't repopulate, to try to keep them from coming back. So those folks end up going somewhere else, like we've seen on Dearborn. That was one of the first camps they cleared. Still clear today, right there under I-90. Still clear. Now, some of those people have moved to closer to Dearborn, and you get off the Dearborn exit going off southbound I-5. There, it's just right there on the left-hand side. Some of them have moved downhill from Harbor View. They're out of view from behind the sound wall. But yeah, certainly some of them have moved, but some are, you know, doing well. In fact, the big one by Sleater-Kinney, it's huge down there in Olympia. They've cleared that entirely to the point, well, not cleared, but they've gotten to the point where most people have not come back there. Now it's a process of going in and trying to take care of that area and make it someplace where they won't repopulate, because it's not safe.
So 2,100 encampments are on the state highways. It's funny you brought up the Dearborn. I just told them the other day, right there by I-90, that has been clear. My drive from Tacoma to Seattle has been 1,000% better. Shout out to Ursula with 1,000%. Has been 1,000% better. 2,100. Do we know how many encampments there were maybe a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, since we're bringing a number up right now?
That one, I can go back and do some reading. I don't have that now. I was just going off the slide deck that they gave me this week.
But it's gotten better.
Yeah, and that was certainly. Right. Yeah, and they're working on it. But then, you know, there's some of these really hidden ones. I want to highlight this. And one of the reasons why this is so dangerous, not only for the people who live there. I mean, I drove by the one on the Ship Canal Bridge yesterday, and one of the tents is like 8 feet from people going 80 miles an hour, protected only by a jersey barrier.
And
I'm like, not only it's not safe for them, but there was this one little encampment just down from Seattle Prep underneath 520 at the west edge of Portage Bay, 101 propane tanks they removed in an area probably the size of this studio, right under the freeway. I'm like, wow. I mean, that propane tanks and the freeways don't mix.
Right.
And that was one that only had 10 people, but they got those folks out of there, found them housing, removed that debris, removed those propane tanks. So, that was one that I didn't even know existed because it was really out of sight. But they're working on it, and I think it's bearing a little bit of fruit. And I think we need to highlight that. But there's a long way to go.
There is a long way to go. And we keep hearing the refrain, well, we have to have a place for them to go or help with services, and they just aren't there. So obviously we know where the emphasis also needs to be, and we need to continue putting pressure on that. I got to ask you, though, because you have such great connections with DOT and others in the know. I have noticed that while a lot of the tents are going away, it seems like the graffiti is just getting worse. And as I drive around,
it's getting
all
more
over the
colorful.
Region, it is.
I'll tell you that.
Oh,
it actually,
my gosh.
I mean, it's bordering on art now in some locations. Some of the stuff I see on, I'm like, wow, that's actually pretty good.
But remember, there was an effort at one point where they were trying to wash out the graffiti, and it was going to be part of the summer, repair work.
Yeah, and
is that
going
to happen?
They
again?
Do that from time to time. They still earmark a couple $100,000 a year to go out there and paint the gray, take care of it. But the issue with that is, it's hard to keep on top of it when you give the ground or seed the ground to the artists overnight. The express lanes are closed to vehicular traffic, so people just walk on the freeway without there being fear of being hit. And so that's where you see it so primarily in that area. And then if you can do that, you can kind of slide down onto the side and hit the main lines on either side too. But that's one of the reasons is it's an open canvas because the road is closed. Now, are they going to do that? I mean, there's going to be a lot more construction going on in the I-5, that express lanes over the next 4 or 5 years. Maybe we'll get, but yeah, I've noticed it too. And it's gotten a lot more intricate, a lot more colors involved. Seems like things that would take an awful long time to do.
Like how do they do it and how do they get to where they're at? And I know that there is, you know, extra notoriety when you can put your graffiti in a place where, wow, people are just going to go, how did they get there? But I'm going to keep hammering on my point of, I think is now that we have the work release programs going again, I say use some of those resources too. I think that needs to be a high priority. Get rid of the graffiti.
The old broken window theory for you. I still think Dave Ross has a really good idea for the amount of money we put into repainting. Just put ivy, fake ivy that you can roll up and down like the louvers on the window, whatever. You just put fake ivy there, and he said that would solve the problem. Probably cheaper than cleaning it up all the time.
Thanks, Sully. Yep. Appreciate it, man. How? By the way, there's some folks that's texting in right now. They said, "Oh, G sounds like he's got a cold."
Yeah, I said the same thing.
Just so you guys know, it happened within the last. What do you think, Ursula? 15 minutes?
Yeah.
So your boy went out there during the break, took a COVID test. I'm all good. Came in and scared Ursula, told her I had COVID, and she said,
Yeah, I've had it once. I don't need it again.
Yeah, so I'm good to go. All right. Hey, coming up next, we need to talk. We need to talk about a situation. What if there was a robbery, right? And the getaway driver was apprehended. How much time in prison do you think that the getaway driver should get when no one was hurt or killed or anything like that? And then what if, you just got to wait to hear the what if next. We do that next. It's the G and Ursula Show. Good morning, everybody. Coming up at 10 o'clock, our favorite Matt Markovich is going to come in to talk about soft on crime. Well, we'll talk about that with Matt next. Right now, we need to talk because earlier in the show, we talked about a prolific car thief with 22 felony conviction who had just been arrested again, this time in Kirkland. Taylor Jacob Norton's bail was set at $50,000 despite his long rap sheet, multiple failures to appear in court, and warrants in two other counties. Ridiculous, right? Now let's look at the other side of the coin. For that, we go to Florida in the story of a man sentenced to 400 years in prison for a crime he did not commit.
A mother running to her son. This is the first time she's hugged him in more than 2 years. You hear the pain of what it's been like for this family to be separated for so long.
I'm just so grateful. I'm just so grateful to God, and I'm so grateful to everybody that made this possible.
All for a crime Sidney Holmes never did. Back in 1988, Holmes was convicted for being a driver in a robbery. He received a 400-year sentence at 23 years old. Attorneys say this was a death wish, but Holmes made it his mission to never give up. So he wrote to the Broward State Attorney's Office's Conviction Review Unit, and after a 2-year investigation, they found that Holmes had no ties to the robbers, no fingerprints or physical evidence to link him to the scene. The state said one flawed witness identification put him in prison for life. But on Monday afternoon,
an order vacating the judgment and the sentence,
Sidney was overcome with emotion, finally being heard after decades behind bars.
He's been in prison since 1988. I want to give you guys more context to this story. He's been in prison since 1988. He was convicted of acting as the getaway driver for two men that committed the robbery. The two robbers still to this day have never been identified. Okay. The victims in this case both said that Holmes should have been released. Some of the deputies that was involved in the original investigation were also shocked at how long Holmes served, which is over 34 years. But he was convicted of being the getaway driver. He got 400 years. Nobody was killed or anything like that. And also, by the way, in this case, it was all because of a mistaken eyewitness account.
You outlined it all. I mean, horrific. Miscarriage of justice. Thank God he didn't give up. Thank God that even the relatives, I think in one case it was the brother of one of the victims, said
they did the investigating.
Yeah, you need to keep investigating because we don't believe it's him.
Right.
We don't think the right person is serving the crime.
400 years. I mean, let's say that he was. And the reason why I preface it like that, let's just say that he was the getaway driver. Let's say that he was. And someone was robbed. 400 years for that? And by the way, this isn't...
But you can never get those years back.
You can never.
And to me, it just... My mind goes to this feeling like we went from one extreme to now a whole different extreme, where we talk about the guy like with 22 felony convictions, and what, he has a $50,000 bail, he can get out on $5,000, probably can get out and, you know, commit more car thefts. Mm-hmm. But here's someone who wasn't even the suspect, but someone who was misidentified by one witness, gets 400 years for being the getaway driver of a robbery.
Of a robbery.
Which is bad. I mean, I think robbery is one of the worst crimes, an armed robbery. But again, he wasn't the one who was committing the robbery. In fact, he wasn't even there.
He wasn't even there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, just imagine the amount of people that are saved today by technology. Because sometimes, if not for technology, we saw this last week, we have no idea where a news story can go. Coming up next on the Gian Ursula Show, Matt Markovich coming in to talk about soft on crime and also security deposits when it comes to renting homes or apartments and everything like that. We do that next. Gian Ursula.